Okay, folks, welcome back. And any questions before we start back? I know, just one reminder that, and I sent this over the weekend and you probably saw it, is there will be this window on April 2nd, where if you turn in your DCF or your intrinsic valuation, I will just give you feedback. It won't be for a grade. I can at least tell you whether you're making some monumental mistake that can, you know, get you in trouble. It's completely optional. So if you feel completely comfortable with your DCF and you want to do it, that's fine. And if you do send it in, just send it the Excel spreadsheet. No need for Purple Pros. If you have assumptions, you can list it in the spreadsheet. And you can use my spreadsheet or you can use your own. And if you build your own, just keep it simple. The one thing I will not let you do is use some investment banking spreadsheet you picked up during the summer and use it, because it just breaks first principles so badly, I just don't trust them. So any questions before we get started? Presumably you've picked a company, you've thought about doing a valuation, so, because that's the first step. So we're gonna start today with, like we do every other class.
Go ahead. I have a question.
Go ahead, Vera.
I was wondering if you knew when our final exam would be.
My graduate classes have given me the final exam. NYU is always late on their undergraduate finals. I checked last week when I checked, they hadn't specified a date because it's set by groups of classes so that you don't get a conflict. So the minute I know it, I will let you know. Because right now I know when my corporate finance evaluation classes for the MBA program have their finals, but I still don't know what the undergraduate does. But I'll check again, see if they've come up with a date. And they usually do it mid-semester, but they should have it by now.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start with the same kind of test that we did, which is at the start of the class. I said we go through and we ask questions about what's coming. So today we're going to talk about the rest of the loose ends. So with that in mind, let me pick on somebody and you can help me apart. Help me out here. I've completed the valuation of a company. I've come up with the value of 100 million, free cash flow to the firm at the cost of capital. And then I get ready to subtract our debt, but then I give you two numbers in the deck. One is the book value of debt, which is 100 million. And the other is the market value of debt, which is 80 million. So you ready for your question? I value the business at 100 million. I have debt with a face value of 100 million, but a market value of 80 million. What is the value of equity in my firm? And I'll give you the choices. Could be 20 million, which is 100 minus the market value of debt. It could be zero if I 100 minus the book value of debt, or maybe it's some number in the middle. So what do you think, what do you think the answer is?
I want to say you use the market value of debt because accountants, you've described in great detail, manipulates book values greatly.
Well, you're right, but in the case of debt, though, what causes the difference in book? Because it's tough to manipulate the book value of debt, right? You owe money. So what usually causes the market value of debt for a company to be much lower than book value?
The market value of the debt being lower than book value, the interest rates of the outside world's changing?
Or the interest rate of the company has changed, right? If its default risk has changed, if it's distressed. You see, and you were right to kind of hold back, because you're right. Every textbook says subtract out market value of debt, and that's what I would suggest you do. But with one caveat, when the value is coming from the fact that you're a distressed company, here's what you have to worry about. If somebody with much better credit risk buys this company, the minute they announce they're going to buy this company, what's going to happen to the market value of debt? The lenders are going to say the person buying the company has a good credit standing. The 80 million is going to climb to 100 million. There goes your 20 million in equity value. So today we're going to talk about when you might use book value debt, because there are conditions under which you might use a book value debt, especially in acquisition valuation or in liquidation valuation. But if you're valuing a company as a going concern, you're right, use the market value of debt. Here's the second one. Sebastian, you're going to help me out here. So I valued the equity in a company using free cash flow equity at the cost of equity. And I've come up with $1 billion as the value of my equity. I have 100 million shares outstanding. So this is the easy part of the question. What's my value per share?
$10.
$10, okay. Everybody agree with that? Now I tell you something I forgot to tell you. This company has been issuing options to its CEO. 10 million options are outstanding. Those options have a strike price of $10 per share. that are the money options. So my question is purely about the effect on your value per share. Before I told you this, you told me your value per share was $10. Now that I've told you this, would you change your value per share?
Would it be a new market cap, but multiplying it by 110 million?
So you're saying it'll increase? So basically you're saying that your value, so your value of equity came from cash flows and discount rates, right? So that nowhere in there is share count even, right? So it comes from the business, the cash flows. That hasn't changed.
Right. So, but the shares outstanding would be higher.
So is that good or bad?
For the value, it would be bad because it would decrease the value per share.
So would that be a final answer, that your value per share will decrease now that I've given you this information?
Yes.
It is the right answer. Okay. So I wasn't trying to push you. The reason I say that is if you showed this to an accountant in 1997, you know what their answer would have been? There would be no effect on value. Mm-hmm. And you know why? What's the strike price of the option?
It's
$10. What's the value per share? It's $10. And here's how the reasoning would go. If you issue options that are at the money, you're giving away nothing. It's like pieces of paper. That's what accountants said from 1991 through 2007. You see how dangerous that is? Because is an option that's at the money worthless? Of course not. It's got life left in it, right? When you have 10 years left, things can happen. Today, we're going to talk about how to deal with management options, how they affect your value per share. But it comes from accounting's wrong-handed view of thinking about what options are worth and how they've changed that view to a much more realistic view now. So let's go back to where I left you in the notes. Remember I presented you with two companies, one simple, one complicated, the numbers were the same. And then I said, hey, complex companies should be worth less. We have to find a way to bring it in. And I said, to do that, I have to do two things. One is I have to come up with a measure of complexity. And the second is I have to convert that measure into one of my numbers, cash flows, discount rates, growth rates, whatever. So when I did this in my class, as I said, I put those two questions out and the MBAs in my class, and I was teaching only an MBA class then, said, why don't you come up with a measure of complexity? You're teaching the class. And I said, okay, I will. So the next week I came back with my first measure of complexity. And I'll tell you up front, they were not impressed. Here's what I used as my measure of complexity. I counted the number of pages in the 10Q and the 10K. Incredibly simplistic, I admit it up front. I just counted the number of pages. Now let me ask you a question. If I showed you these 10 companies and I said, which of these 10 companies would you least want to value? Angela, which of these 10 companies would you least want to value?
Sorry, Professor, I'm not sure.
Anybody want to try? Which of these 10 companies would you least want to value?
Citigroup.
And why? What is it about Citigroup that scares you?
The atrocious number of pages?
1,020 pages in a 10K. I'll tell you something. If it takes you, this isn't War and Peace. This is how many pages it takes Citigroup to tell you what happened in 1 year. If it takes you 1,000 pages to tell me what happened last year, God help you. And God help me, this is one hell of a messed up company. So I put this up for my MBAs. They're not impressed. They said, we're not paying $150,000 to count pages. We want something more sophisticated. And I said, you're right. So it's my video off here. I said, okay, I'm going to come up with something more complicated, more sophisticated. So next week I came back with a different measure. And I call this my valuation shit list. You heard me right. It was a measure of complexity that brought in all the stuff they wanted me to. I'll tell you, it's completely subjective. It's based on my experiences. And here's what I was trying to do. I was trying to bring in things that bug me about companies when I valued them, put them into a spreadsheet, tell you how much they bug me and come up with a score. The higher the score, the more complex the company. So I'll give you a couple of examples of things that bug me and why they bug me. A company that claims to be geographically diversified but doesn't tell you where. Then why tell me in the first place? Or tells you it's geographically diversified and tells you the parts of the world they're in, but you don't recognize any of the parts, like a Lord of the Rings universe. You say, where is that? or a company that has a tax rate that jumps around, goes from 83% to minus 53%. I know it's completely subjective, but I built a spreadsheet around it. I came up with a score and I presented my MBAs and I said, do you like this more? And they said, this is so much better than that number of pages crap you showed us last week. I said, okay, but there's one small cost to using this spreadsheet. To come up with the score for Citigroup, what do I need to do? I need to read 1,020 pages, right? I said, I'm not willing to do that, but each of you is valuing a company this semester, right? And they could see the train coming at them down the tracks. Too late to get out of the way now. They said, yes. And I said, this semester, in addition to valuing your company, why don't you come up with a complexity score for your company? They bitched and they moaned, but what choice did they have? They should have just taken my number of pages measure the previous week and run with it. That they pushed me and now they had it. And that semester, in addition to valuing their companies, they came back with a complexity score for their companies. And they found some very interesting things. First, they found almost no correlation between the size of a company and how complex it was. I thought big companies would be more complex than small companies. No such thing. Second, they found that emerging market companies were more complex than developed market companies, usually because of cross-holding structures. Third, they found that any company that grew through acquisitions was automatically about 20% more complex than a company that grew with internal projects. You know why, right? When you grow through acquisitions, what do you start to see on your balance sheet that's a pain in the neck to work with? What's the item that pops up the day after you do the balance sheet or you do an acquisition? Goodwill. You see goodwill and there's impairment of goodwill and restructuring charges and all that stuff. And finally, any company with a financing arm was about 35% more complex than a company without it. You know what I mean by financing arm? GM, GMAC, Ford Capital. You've embedded a bank in your company and said, trust me, the bank ends here, the company starts over here. And that semester, there were 300 people in the class, the most complex company in the class. I want somebody to guess. So I'll give you the characteristics of a complex company. It's usually a company that grows through acquisitions, has a financing arm, is often in multiple businesses in many parts of the world. The company is a pale shadow of what it used to be. Do you know who I'm describing? In 2002? It was GE. Now, I tell people, look, and I'm not looking for this job, but if I ever got to hell and the devil made me his assistant, say, you're in charge of this section of hell. Let's call it the investment banker section of hell, and gave me full power to design that section of hell. Here's what that section of hell would look like. You as an investment banker come down to hell. First, you're pissed off, you're in the wrong place. You thought you were in the other place, but it's too late now. Now, you're in my section. Here's what you will have to do for the rest of eternity. You'll have to value GE over and over and again. So you've seen Groundhog Day? You'll have like Groundhog Day. Every day you'd get up and you're gonna value GE over. This is my vision of hell. It's an incredibly messed up company. And that I think should give you some insight into why complexity is so dangerous. When times are good, people overlooked it, right? When Jack Welch built the company, people thought he was a genius. Look, it's amazing, he's part of GE Capital. It's when you get into trouble that it becomes so difficult to fix or extricate yourself from that trouble. So can I measure complexity? Yes. I'd have preferred the number of pages, but if you push me, I can come up with the complexity score. But that's not enough, right? To affect my value, it's got to show up somewhere. Remember the it proposition? So here are the places I can reflect complexity in my value. I can try to reduce my cash flows by doing what? By haircutting my earnings, saying it's a complex company. I'm going to knock earnings off by 10%. Completely arbitrary. I hate doing that. The second is by adjusting my discount rate, pushing the discount rate up for complex companies. By how much? In fact, when I did this this month on complexity, remember I spent a month on each loose end. One of the things I looked at was how much higher the cost of capital were for complex companies opposed to simple companies in the same business. And I got a difference of about 1%, which means after you've done your cost of capital, you had an extra 1% for complex companies, you have a higher discount rate and a lower value. But I'll tell you my preferred device for dealing with complexity. what do we say drives the value of growth? The return you make relative to your cost of capital. So let's say you're valuing a company with a 20% return on capital. That's good, right? It's earning well above its cost of capital. If you understand what this company does, it's completely transparent, then you can make assumptions about its competitive advantages and how long that 20% return on capital will last. But let's suppose you have a company where you have no idea what the company does. It's an incredibly complex company. You see a 20% return on capital. You're not even suspicious that they're doing any accounting gameplay. But if I ask you, will this return continue in the future? Your reaction should be, I really don't know what the company does. And if I don't, how can I assume they can keep doing this in the future? So you know what I do with companies that I don't quite understand? The complexity gets in the way. I take their existing return on capital and very quickly move it down to the cost of capital, which effectively means they can have high growth, but I've removed their biggest way of adding value from growth. So if you don't like complex companies, bring it into the cash flows, the discount rate, or that expected return on capital in the future that'll lower the value of complex companies. Finally, as a throwaway, when I was doing this topic, here's what I did. I took the 100 largest market cap companies in the US. I took their price to book ratios, market value of equity divided by book value of equity, classic multiple. And I ran a regression against return on equity, growth, beta, which are kind of standard variables you use when you try to explain price to book. And we'll come back later in this class and talk about why. But then I threw in the number of pages in my 10K. You see that? Minus 0.003. You know what that tells me? Every 100 additional pages in your 10K is going to lower your price to book ratio by 0.3. You know what Citigroup's price to book was when I did this? It was like trading at less than book value, 0.9. I have a very simple suggestion for Citigroup to double its price to book ratio. All it has to do is knock 300 pages off the 10K. It sounds facetious, but there's a core of truth to it, and here's why. You know why Citigroup had 1,000 pages in its 10K in 2000? It's because in 1997, Citicorp and Travelers Group came together and created what they called was the biggest financial supermarket in the world. It was going to be all things to all people, insurance company, real estate arm, banking, investment, it was going to be everything. And guess what? They succeeded in creating an incredibly complicated company with 1,000-page 10K. So do I worry about complexity? Yes. Some of you are going to be valuing companies where you run into these mazes where things are opaque and it's clearly by design. The company's holding back stuff. Get pissed off if you want to, but ultimately, if you want to shorten your valuation as a higher discount rate or return on capital that comes down to the cost of capital, that's your best revenge rather than sitting there and bitching and moaning about how little the company is telling you about its future. Any questions about complexity? So now let's talk about debt. There are two places in valuation where you run into debt. The first is when you compute cost of capital, right? You need a debt to put into your debt ratio and your cost of capital. And the rule there is very simple. Be narrow in your definition of debt. Narrow in the sense you count all interest-bearing debt and lease commitments. And you stop there. You don't add things like underfunded pension obligations. You're saying, but I'm worried about them. Yes, you're worried about them. You want to be conservative, but don't include them in debt, because if you include them in debt, you know what's going to happen, right? Your debt ratio is going to get higher. Your cost of capital is actually going to get lower. So when you do cost of capital, define debt narrowly. Once you've defined the debt, you come up with the cost of capital. What do you do? Use that cost of capital to come up with the value of the business. And this was the question I asked at the start of the class to us. You valued a company. Do you subtract out market value, book value? And here I've made it even more extreme. What if the market value is half of book value? It's a tremendously distressed company. Should you still subtract out market value? The answer is yes, if you're valuing this company as a going concern. Where you say eventually the debt is going to get paid off. It's very risky debt. I'm going to bring it into the cost of capital. But if you're doing a liquidation valuation, guess what? That bank is going to insist that you pay them the entire billion. They're not going to say, just pay me half the money because you're in trouble. So in liquidation value or acquisitions, be careful about what you net out to get to value of equity. Because what you see as the market value of debt reflects the current company's distress, and that might not be the number that fits when you're an acquiring company. So you got the value of the firm with the right cost of capital. You subtract out the market value of debt as a going concern. You get ready to brush off your hands and move on. Stop and check. Check and make sure that there's nothing else you worry about as an equity investor. Remember I talked about underfunded pension obligations? So you made all these pension promises. You don't have enough money set aside to cover them. You're legally obligated to make those pension payments. You have an underfunded pension plan. I wouldn't treat that as debt, but if I'm an equity investor in this company, I've got to worry. Somebody's got to come up with the money. So I might subtract it out, even though it's not debt in my cost of capital. But here's the other thing to worry about. If you're a company targeted in a lawsuit, if you lose that lawsuit, especially if it's a lawsuit that cuts to the heart of your existence, your value of equity as a company could be affected by dramatic amounts. You know, the sector where we've had this issue to deal with for the last 40 years, right? What's a sector where lawsuits have kind of hung over the sector for the last 40 years? And every time you value a company in the sector, you have to bring in the expected cash outflows due to lawsuits. Anybody? Kumar?
Is it like pharmaceuticals maybe?
Pharmaceuticals, this might be coming, but historically we have lawsuits. They tend to be smaller, but you're right. Merck's, you know, the painkillers. So it is, you know, it is something, especially in the last decade, that pharmaceuticals have to deal with. But there's another sector at least with pharmaceuticals, one drug or two drugs that get in trouble. There's a sector where its entire product is under legal assault. Arun?
Would it be tech?
Well, maybe you want to sue them, but what big lawsuit hangs over Facebook or Google? It's maybe regulatory concerns, but I don't see a Caleb.
Would it be like chemicals like DuPont, for example?
Good try. They're under challenge as well. I guess there aren't too many smokers in this room.
Cannabis?
For 40 years, tobacco has been at the heart of the storm, right? Because it's been sued. You got class action suits. You got how many movies have been made about tobacco and the lawsuits? So when you value a tobacco company, guess what you have to do? You have to set aside money from your equity to cover the expected payments from lawsuits. Now, I've seen quite a few cannabis companies valued in the last few years. And the cautionary note, so people send me these valuations, what should I be worrying about? I say, take a look at the tobacco companies, because it's coming for cannabis. If it's not here now, it will be here sooner or later. If you think you're not going to get lawsuits in cannabis, you're dreaming. You've got to set aside that amount. Which brings me to my final loose end, which is a lot of companies compensate their employees with equity. What form? Either restricted shares or with options. How many of you are graduating at the end of this semester? Nobody's graduating? Come on, somebody must be graduating. Bridger, are you graduating?
Yeah.
Do you have a job offer yet? Is it a painful thing you don't want to have? You have? You do?
Yeah.
Who is it from?
Credit Suisse.
Okay. There you're probably not good. But if, let's say you got a job offer from Airbnb. Hey, do you think Airbnb can afford to match what Credit Suisse is paying you in terms of, they can't, they don't have the cash. So let's say you get I'll up your pay so you won't get it. Let's say Credit Suisse is promising to pay Bridge you $500,000 a year. That's roughly what they've told you, right? Your annual salary is going to be $500,000 a year. You think Airbnb can match Credit Suisse? You know who the largest employer at Stern was in the MBA program last year, right? It was Amazon. This is no longer a trading school where Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley are getting tech firms come in and hire MBAs. And the problem with tech firms historically is they've not been able to match what a Goldman Sachs or a Credit Suisse can offer in terms of cash. So you know what these tech firms offer? They come to an MBA and say, look, we can't pay you the $200,000 that Goldman Sachs is paying. But here's what we can do. We'll pay you $100,000, which is like poverty wages in the Bay Area to find housing, but you get the $100,000. But you also get, you know, $200,000 worth of options or $250,000 worth of restricted stock. And why are they doing that? Because they don't have the cash to match the competitors. Hold on to the thought, because that's going to allow us to answer what to do about the stock-based compensation. This is not a one-time deal. This is now part of your compensation package every year, because that's how they keep you. So the two questions I want to address here. One is, what do you do about option grants and restricted shares that a company has given in the past? And the second is, what do we do about expected option grants and restricted shares that a company might offer in the future? Two separate questions. So let's start with looking at the two ways in which employees get equity compensation from companies. The easier problem, in my view, from a valuation perspective, this makes my life easier, if you get restricted shares. So Tim Park, do you know what the, when you get restricted shares, what are the restrictions on?
That you're restricted to sell and buy.
One is restrictions on trading. You get these shares, but even before you get to buy or sell, you know what else you need to do, right? You need to vest. What does that mean? You have to stay with the company 2-3 years before you can even get those shares. So there's a vesting period, and then there's an extended period where you can't sell the shares. That's the restricted shares. But they're regular shares, like any other shares. So let's say you're valuing a company. It's got 100 million regular shares, but it's got 30 million restricted shares. Would you count the restricted shares as part of the share count? Absolutely. I've never understood why people say, well, in fact, the reason I say that is you look at Airbnb's prospectus, they actually list the shares outstanding. And then they say, oh, by the way, we didn't count all these restricted stock units that we've offered employees. So why? I guess the bankers told them you don't have
to. Yeah, that was also.
I'm sorry?
Sorry. My dog was acting up. Yeah.
Okay. So basically, the restricted shares have restrictions on trading and vesting, but you should still count them as shares outstanding. And that's easier problem. So if you have a lot of restricted shares, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to add them to the share count and move on. But if you have options, I have a bigger challenge, and here's why. You know how an option works, right? I give you the right to buy shares at a fixed price. It's called a strike price. And what makes options troublesome for companies is that strike price. So when options get exercised, they get exercised because the market price is much higher than the strike price. Nobody exercises options at the money. They wait for the stock price to go up. So there are Tesla employees who got options to buy the shares at $200 per share, saying, what a great deal. They got them when the stock was trading at 80 or 100. So when it was granted, it seemed like a freebie. They have an option, $200. Stock, of course, went as high as $900 per share. Did they exercise? A lot of them did. That's what you worry about. You're selling your shares at a discount, which means the remaining shareholders essentially are making up the difference. Some companies actually use their cash flows to buy shares and set them aside to cut, but you still have the same problem. Options are a problem, not because you've given somebody the right to buy shares, but because you've given them the right to buy shares at a fixed price. So let me go back to the example that I started the class with and talk about the different ways in which we can deal with options, starting with what I call the bludgeon approach. I hate it, but you see people doing it, to a middle ground approach, which a lot of analysts like, called the treasury stock approach, to the approach that I think is the right approach, where you deal with options the right way. So here's what my company looks like. It has 100 million in cash flow, grows 3% a year with an 8% cost of capital. So if you bring those three numbers together, you get a value for the firm of $2 billion. It is $1 billion in debt. You subtract out, you get a value of equity of $1 billion. Let's say it is 100 million shares. Value per share is $10. So now in this company, I introduce a quirk. I said, this company has given 10 million options to its CEO to buy shares at $10 per share at exactly the market price. Now, if I showed this to my accountants in 1995, they'd say, you know what, that shouldn't affect your value per share. Why? Because you're giving away this right to buy shares at the existing price, and that shouldn't affect. It's called an at-the-money option. And I think we argued right at the start of this class that that's not true. Even if you give options that are at the money, you've given away a piece of equity in the firm. The question is, how do you bring that into value? So let's start with what I call the bludgeon approach. It's called the diluted share count. And here's what you do. You stay with the $1 billion equity value you came up with before by discounting cash flows at the cost of equity. But instead of dividing by the 100 million shares outstanding, you divide by 110 million shares. You count the options as if they're shares outstanding. You see what they're trying to do is that just these options could be exercised. We're being conservative. We're going to count them as shares. You know how incredibly unfair this approach is? Even if you assume those options will get exercised, what is this approach not factoring in that should be factored in? If Rodrigo is my CEO, he gets 10 million options and he decides to exercise the options. How does this process work? I give Rodrigo 10 million shares, right? And what does Rodrigo have to do? He has to pay me the exercise price, right? That options basically work two ways. And how much will he have to pay as an exercise price? 10 times 10, because it's $10 per share. 10 million times $10 per share is $100 million, which will come into the firm. And this approach completely misses that. Do you know what the treasury stock approach does? It brings in the 100 million that Rodrigo is going to pay me into the numerator, saying that's going to come into the firm. That's going to increase my value from a billion to 1.1 billion. It divides by the 110 million shares. And here's the magic. In the treasury stock approach, the value per share remains unchanged because the options are at the money. It's the approach that most analysts use when they value companies with options. The danger in this approach is we're assuming that options have no time premium, that an at-the-money option is worth nothing, and we know that's not true. Options have value. So you can already see what I'm going to do, right? Those 10 million options that are at the money, if I can somehow value those options as options, what does that mean? Bring in the time premium, the remaining life, the variance, and value those options. Remember, every time I give away a slice of equity in the company, that's a piece of your equity that was given away. There are no freebies here. So when I give those options, I've given away a piece of your equity. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to subtract the value of the options from the value of the equity. And then I'm going to divide by the actual shares outstanding, the 100 million. I don't count the 10 million as shares because the value of the options already takes care of that. I'm going to get a value per share. We've known this right from the beginning when options were first started to get granted. But for the longest time, the accountants pushed back. And their response was, you cannot use the Black-Scholes option pricing model, the binomial option pricing model, models that we were using elsewhere in valuing employee options. And there was a basis for their argument. Because employee options are different. And here's why they're different. First, a typical option you buy on the CBOE, the Chicago Board of Options, like 3 months. They tend to be short-term options. Option pricing models were designed for 3-month options, 2-month options. But a typical employee option is often 10 years, much more long-term. Second, when you buy an option on the CBOE and you exercise it, the company is not affected. It's between you and somebody else. It's a third-party transaction. But in an employee option, when shares get issued, the company issues the shares. There could be dilution. And finally, with a traditional option, the rule is don't ever exercise the option. You'll always make more money by selling the option than by exercising it. But with employee options, because they're not liquid, if the stock price shoots up, even though there's a remaining life of the option, you might exercise early. So you're right. If I take the traditional Black-Scholes model, apply it on employee options blindly, I will overvalue these options. But there's a way in which you can adapt these models. In fact, it's fairly simple to design a modified version of the Black-Scholes just for employee options. And here are the modifications. One is, instead of using the current stock price, which is what you're trained to use in the Black-Scholes model, you adjust the stock price for the fact that if the option gets exercised today, there'll be dilution. So instead of using the $10 per share, I use a lower stock price. What does that do? It reduces the value of the option for the dilution. And I could even take the 10-year life that I have in the option and say, typically employees exercise early, so I'm going to use a 5-year life. If I use a 5-year life and I use a lower stock price, I'm going to come up with a lower value for the option, but I'm definitely not going to get zero, which is what the accountants were using. In fact, the value that I got for these options, which are at the money with 10 years left to maturity, was $5.42 per option. When I gave Rodrigo 10 million options, you know how much I was giving him? I was giving him $54.2 million worth of equity. And here's how I bring it in. I take the $1 billion I had for the value of equity. I subtract out the 54.2 million that I paid Rodrigo. I come up with 945.8 million. I divide the 945 million by 100 million. Let me reemphasize again, go back to the original count. Don't double count by increasing the share count now. Just stay with 100 million. The value per share that I get is 946. The minute I issued those options, I made my shares less valuable because I've given away a slice of equity in the company. So this is what we should be doing. And this is why in every one of my DCF models, you see the option spreadsheet built into the model. Because I ask you how many options you have outstanding. The minute you do that, I go to the spreadsheet, I value the options, I net it out from the value of equity, because it's part of your equity that's left on the table. Now we can debate whether we should multiply the value of this equity by this, these options by 1 minus the tax rate. I would just skip it. I mean, if you really want to bring it in, multiply 1 minus the tax rate, because option expense are tax deductible, I can live with that. But with today's tax law, I don't think you need to do this. Just subtract out the value of the entire options. So that's how we deal with restricted stock and options that have already been issued. Restricted share stock pushes up the share count, option reduces the value of equity. But many of these companies are not done. They're going to continue to give options in the future. And 20 years ago, bringing these in took a lot of extra work. But let me give you a little bit of a history of how accounting treatment of employee options has changed over time and how it's changed company behavior. The growth, the surge in using options as part of compensation happened in the 1990s during the dot-com boom. You had all these young companies, they wanted to give their managers and employees high salaries, but they couldn't afford it with cash, so they gave them options. So every company would go out millions of options. And because the accountant said it doesn't cost you any money, they gave out way too many options. They'd give a 100 million option grant, not even think about it, because it was not showing up as an expense. Finally, in 2007, accounting said, this is getting way out of hand. And they decided to do what I think should have been the right thing from the beginning. They said, rather than give companies a freebie, the year in which you grant the option, we're going to treat it as an expense. You know how we're going to come up with the expense? We're going to use an option pricing model. We finally convinced accountants that you could value options with an option pricing model. So in 2007, if I'd given this grant, that 54.8 million would show up as an expense in my income statement, lowering my income and lowering my earnings per share. That's good, right? Finally, accountants are doing the right thing. So two things happened. The first was companies started shifting away from options to restricted stock because you no longer had a freebie. And restricted stock, as I said, is a much healthier way to give equity in your companies. You know the second thing that happened? Companies started reversing what accountants were doing and giving you numbers before that expense. You know what I'm talking about, right? In many of these, many companies, especially young companies, you see something called adjusted EBITDA. You're saying, what is adjusted EBITDA? It'll be whatever the accountant says is EBITDA. But instead of stopping there, here's what the accountant, what the company does. It adds back stock-based compensation. In other words, they're taking all the hard work that was done to bring it onto the books and reversing it. Stupid practice. I don't even know why analysts go along with this. But they do it because they act like stock-based compensation is not an expense. It is an expense. It is compensation. It should be left as an expense. You shouldn't be adding it back. But they continue to do it. Final point about options. If you think about what it is that drives the value of an option, it's high variance and a long life for the option. We think about the kinds of companies that give options. They tend to be young, risky tech companies. Do you see where I'm going? The kinds of companies where options get granted are exactly the kinds of companies where options can have huge values. You cannot afford to be sloppy about them. You cannot afford to use the treasury stock approach. You have to value the options as options. Any questions about the loose ends? Go ahead, Joe.
So about stock compensation. So like, let's say you're looking at a report from like the quarter after a direct listing or an IPO. Sometimes there's like a really big stock compensation, I guess from the direct listing or something. So
no, that shouldn't be from the direct listing. The only thing you have to show as a compensation expense is the new options were granted during that quarter. What you will see is the dead weight of all previous options, because remember, this company has been granting options well before it went public. So what usually happens is after it gets listed, all those options will now show up in the footnotes as options outstanding. So, you know, very few companies right after the IPO start giving out options, because it's really something they've been doing on a continuous basis. You're just seeing the accumulation of all the options they gave as private companies now becoming options in the public company.
Got it. So should we assume that's a one-time thing, or at least for now?
Well, the expense is not a one-time thing. So what you see in the income statement is actually stock compensation for that quarter, the options granted during that quarter. And I don't think, when I look at IPOs, you don't see a big surge just in that quarter. Some might, but that might be options they decided somebody's going to get as a reward. I would track them for a few quarters, because sometimes you can have options being granted to people who are leaving. Now, just take the options and go. So check it, but you know, if it continues, just treat it as a regular expense.
Thank you.
Rebecca?
Yeah, so my financial company for like the DCF basically uses adjusted EBITDA in its finance statements. So like, is there a way, like, should we ignore that completely, or should we like?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's complete fiction. It's complete fiction. Okay. But you have the full income statement. I mean, so in a sense, we never have to take a company's word, right? We have the actual EBITDA. They play games with it by adding all this crap on. Now, what you're looking for, what are legitimate add-ons, are things that were one time. Things that are non-operating, right? So I look through the list, and if there's an item that's non-operating and one time, then I'm going to allow them to add them back. Stock-based compensation is neither, right? It's every quarter, because you got to pay people, and it's not one time. So I think that you have to kind of ignore the stuff that they do, because they're trying to make it look like they're making money when they're not.
Thank you.
Okay. So now let's turn to what I think is really the heart of this class, because anybody can teach you the equations, the Excel spreadsheets, you can pick it up from a book. I want to talk a little bit about how to connect your stories to numbers. And as I do this, I want you to think about your company, because I'm going to go through the process of how I value companies, the sequence I go through. But what I'm trying to do is build this bridge between stories and numbers. So the company I'm going to use, you're going to see in a minute, is a company that all of you are familiar with. You use it pretty much every day. Some of you do, some of you use it 3-4 times a day. But I'm going to take you through a 5-step process using this company. The first step when you sit down to value a company is what I call survey the landscape. Sounds fancy, but to value a company, what do you need to do? You need to understand what the company does, what business it's in, what the competition looks like. That's the first step, right? I remember the first time I valued Beyond Meat at the time of its IPO. You know the first thing I did before I valued Beyond Meat? I went to the grocery store, to the frozen section, and I picked up Beyond Meat. I think I picked one of the ground, you know, everything Beyond Meat is made from pea protein. So they made this taco meat, and I love tacos with pea protein. And I wanted to see how close to meat they got. Why did I do that? Because the essence of Beyond Meat is they sell a product that they claim is so close to meat that a meat lover can eat it with and not really know. So the first step is understanding the company. And for many of you, this has been, you know, you're trained to go to Capital IQ, download the financials. That's all useful. But to understand a company, you know what you need to do, right? Talk to people who use the product. You have to understand the company. So I'll take you back to June of 2014. I think it was June 2nd. I open up the Wall Street Journal. I see a news story. And here's what the news story says. A company called Uber had raised $3 billion. No, Siri spoke up. A company called Uber had raised $3 billion from venture capitalists who had priced the company at $17 billion. And I was shocked. I was shocked because here's a company I'd never heard of with a $17 billion pricing. You think, how could you not hear about Uber? Well, I lived in New Jersey. I took the train in the city. I took the subway. I never took car service anywhere to me. Actually, let me take that back. I said I'd never heard of Uber. I'd seen the word Uber on my credit card statements in the 2 months leading into June 2nd. And it turned out that my second son was going to college in North Carolina. I was using Uber and using my credit card to back it up. Don't ask me how that happened. But I thought he was taking German language classes, to be quite honest. The no umlaut on the U should have given it away. But I wanted to find out more about the company. So to start my valuation, guess what I did? And look at the financials. There were no financials of the company. It's a small private company. There was almost nothing out there. So I called my son in North Carolina. So I said, and I call him, it's 11:30 in the morning. He doesn't pick up his phone. He's still sleeping. He was keeping what I call college student hours. Some of you might be familiar with that, which is you go to sleep and you feel like going to sleep, you wake up when you feel like waking up. The sun, the moon, none of this has anything to do with when you sleep or when you're awake. And he wouldn't answer the phone. So I called my niece, who lived and worked in Chicago, and she had to be awake because she had a job. So she was technically awake at her desk. Her eyes were open, but she was in a horrifically bad mood. She picks up the phone and she says, "What do you want?" That's how she starts the conversation. So I said, "Have you heard of a company called Uber?" She said, "It's a ride-sharing company." I said, "What the heck is a ride-sharing company?" She said, "I don't have the time to tell you. Why don't you just download the app and find out for yourself?" Hangs up the phone. I should talk to her mother about this behavior, but I sit in my office at NYU 44 West 4th Street. I download the app. I hit the app. Magical things start to happen on my phone. A GPS opens up and I can see a car trying to drive towards me. Why? Because it's New York City. You don't get from point A to point B, you just try. You go down one-way streets, you're blocked, you go around. So I can see the car zigging and zagging, trying to get to 44 West 4th Street. And I can see a name in the car. It says George. This has never happened to me with a yellow cab. I'm fascinated. 15 minutes later, George and his car pull up in front of 44 West 4th Street. I run out and say, "Hi, George." He says, "You didn't enter a destination. Where do you want to go?" I said, "Nowhere in particular. Can you drive me around for about 30 minutes? I have some questions to ask you." He briefly thought I was a serial killer, but then he said, "You know what? I think I can take you. Get in the back seat." So I get in the back seat, start asking him questions. I said, "Is this an Uber car you're driving?" He said, "No, this is my car." I said, "Are you an Uber employee?" He said, "No, I'm an independent contractor." I said, "Why do you do this?" He said, "I have a regular job. I don't make much money at that job. I already own this car and Uber allows me to make a second income on the car." So I asked him, "Why do you need Uber?" He said, "In New York City, it's illegal to stop on the street and offer someone a ride. Uber connects me with customers." I said, "Okay, that makes sense." 20 minutes later, he drops me back at NYU and I offered to pay him. "You should have just taken the money." He said, "You don't have to pay me." I said, "It's free?" He said, "No, it's not free. When you downloaded the app, they ask you for a credit card." I said, "Yes." He said, "They will charge you. Uber will charge you." And then I remember asking, "How do you get paid?" He said, "They'll send me 80% of the fare." And I remember asking, "Why 80%? He said, "I don't know. That's what they all do." And he drives off. At this stage, I had a sense of why Uber did what they did. For connecting cars to customers, they got 20% of the fare. Which left me with one final question. What is so special about Uber that my son and my niece like the company so much? So I decided to call my son again, this time at a civilized hour, and he had no choice but to be awake, like 3:30 in the afternoon. He was finally awake. And I decided to put him on the defensive right away. You can extract more information that way. I said, "No. I've been noticing you've been using my credit card for your ride sharing." And I didn't even know what ride sharing was until I talked to my niece, but I acted like I knew. "Why are you doing that? You own a car down in North Carolina. Why would you need to use a ride sharing service?" And I still remember what he told me. He said, "Dad, on Friday nights and Saturday nights, I really like Uber." Now, as a parent, there are some follow-up questions you never ask, but I kind of got what he was saying. I said, "What do you like about Uber?" Because this is a kid who would never call a yellow cab. It's not even in his frame of reference. He wouldn't even know where to start. So what do you like about Uber? He said, "I can call the car from the bar." I said, "That's a plus." I said, "But you must wait forever, right?" He said, "No, they come faster than a cab." I said, "But they must be really expensive, right?" He said, "They're cheaper than a cab." So cars must be filthy, right? He said, they're cleaner than a cab. I said, let me get this straight. They come sooner than a cab. They're cheaper than a cab. They're cleaner than a cab. I knew that that moment that cab service was destined for doom. That ride sharing is going to win out, which left me with one final question, which is, what makes Uber so special? Why couldn't I start my own ride sharing service in my basement with a big computer, connect drivers to customers? And I could think of two things that Uber had that I didn't. The first was $3 billion. They had it, I did not, a little bit of a disadvantage. The second is that they were there first. You're saying, so what? This is a business with networking benefits. You know what that means? As companies get bigger, it actually gets easier to get bigger. And here's why. If you're a driver and you want to drive for a ride-sharing service, do you want to go with the established ride-sharing service or the one that's a startup? I'm going to go with the established service because that's where all the customers are. And if you're a customer who wants to download an app to your phone, you don't want to start with the startup ride-sharing service where there are no cars around. You want to go with the ride-sharing service where there are hundreds of cars around. And you know what I did after I did this research? Because this was what passed for research. There was no ratio analysis. There was no downloading of financials. It was talking to people. I drew a picture of what I've learned about the company. It's very simple. It said, hey, here's why drivers like to drive for Uber. It allows them to earn a second income. Here's what Uber gets out of this. Here's why customers like Uber. Here's what makes Uber different from its competitors. This is going to be the landscape from which I'm going to build my story. And I'd encourage you, once you've learned about your company, and you can do financials if you want, and think about what your company does. What makes its products different from its competitors? Why do customers like or dislike its products? Because that's going to be the foundation for the next step. So surveying the landscape sounds fancy, but it's just talking to people, looking at the financials, getting a sense of what the story for your company is going to be. So now comes the storytelling part. And my only suggestion to you is remember, you're telling a business story, not writing a creative novel. So don't create characters who wander on and off for no reason at all. It's just distraction. I'll tell you what kind of story you should not be telling. About 15 years ago, my oldest son came to me with a reading suggestion. He said, Dad, you should read this book, amazing book. And I take my kids' reading suggestions very seriously. So I ask him for the book and he gives me the book, and it's a book that says Game of Thrones. It's like 1200 pages long. So I get started on it. 2 weeks later, I remember calling my son saying, hey Ryan, I'm too old for this. There are hundreds of characters in this book. They wander on, they wander off, they die, they come back to life, they're good, they're bad. I've kind of given up on this. I couldn't finish the book. If you tell a business story, don't make it Game of Thrones. You don't have 8 seasons and 80 episodes to tell your story. You have like 15 minutes. Keep it short and keep it focused. Focus on what? No matter what story you tell, as an investor, what do you need to convince me? That you've thought about a way of making money. Is that asking too much? If you ask me to invest in your business, how do you plan to make money that you haven't even thought about that? So this evening, here's what I want you to do. If you turn on CNBC anytime after like the market closes, Shark Tank episode after Shark Tank episode, right? Watch it actively. As founders pitch their stories, ask yourself, are they telling a focused story? Are they keeping it simple? Some of them do, a lot of them don't. So here's my story for Uber. I'm going to describe Uber as an urban car service company. And this is in June of 2014. The reason I emphasize the date is I've valued Uber every year since 2014, including their IPO. Do you think my story for Uber changed over time? Of course it did. Why? Because the world changed around me. I learned things about the company. In June of 2014, my story was that Uber would be an urban car service company. I'm already telling you where I see Uber succeeding, right? Cities and big towns. As a car service company. That'll attract new users into the business. People like my son and niece who would not have taken taxi cabs are going to come into this business, making the big business bigger. With local networking benefits. You know what I mean by local networking benefits? If Uber becomes the largest ride-sharing company in New York, it'll end up dominating New York. But if I fly to Chicago, I no longer care who the largest ride-sharing company in New York is. I care about the largest ride-sharing company in Chicago. So in my world, Uber can end up taking New York, Lyft can take Chicago, Didi can take Beijing, Grab can take Kuala Lumpur, and Ola can take Mumbai. Why does that matter? The kind of market share I give Uber will reflect this part of the story. And finally, I'm going to assume that Uber can keep doing what they're doing, which in 2014 was not owning the cars and not hiring the drivers. That's going to be my story for Uber. You're going to see this play out in the numbers. So that's step two, tell a story. And I want you to think about the story. So don't tell me an elaborate novel. Keep it focused, keep it simple. Because in step three, I want you to stop and make sure the story you've told me or the story I've told you is not a fairy tale. In fact, I want you to take your story through three tests. Is it possible? Is it plausible? Is it probable? Sounds like I'm playing on words, right? Possible means you can show me it can be done, that this is not something that's impossible. Plausible means somebody else has done something like this before. Probable means you've done something, at least in a test market, that convinces me that I can actually put a number on this. Is it possible, plausible, probable? With each one, I'm raising the ante. I've actually struggled with ways of illustrating the difference between these three P words because a lot of people have no idea what I'm talking about. And about 2017, I think it was October, I was actually in Latin America doing this session on narrative and numbers to three different audiences in three cities on three consecutive days. On day one, I was in Sao Paulo, Brazil, talking to 300 Brazilians about stories and numbers. On day two, I was in Santiago, Chile, talking to 100 Chileans about stories and numbers. On day three, I was in Lima, Peru. So I'm thinking, you know, first day I land in Brazil, 300 Brazilians in a room. I want to pick a topic where every person in that room has a passionate view on that topic. So Rodrigo, as a Brazilian, what's a one topic you can talk about in Brazil where everybody in the room will have an opinion on the topic?
Soccer. Yeah.
So this is 6 months before the last World Cup. I ask a question, is it possible that Brazil will win the World Cup? You ask 300 Brazilians 6 months before a World Cup, is it possible? What do you think the answer was? It was unanimous.
Of course, yeah.
Of course, we've done it five times before, right? Then I said, is it plausible that Brazil will win the World Cup? You know what, if I'd asked this question in December of 2014 in that room, things would have been a little shaky. Rodrigo can probably tell you what happened in 2014. Most Brazilians have shut this out of their memory, but we know what happened in 2014, right? That was a World Cup year. There was a World Cup in Rio, and Brazil and Germany played in the semifinals in perhaps Brazil's worst nightmare ever. If you remember, that was a game that got out of hand. They lost 8-2. But by 2017, they were feeling much better. Their amnesia had kicked in about that loss. They were number two ranked. They said, it's plausible. But there was a little more thinking together. Then I said, is it probable that Brazil won the World Cup? And now you could see the wheels go into motion. If Neymar stays healthy and we're put in the right group and we don't play this team and this team, then I think we have a pathway. You see where this is going? With each step, you have to come up with a story that's richer or deeper. And I was really happy with how it worked out. So I said, maybe I should try this in Santiago, Chile tomorrow. I should have done my homework, but I did not. So I land in Santiago, I walk into that room, 100 Chileans in the room, and I ask, is it possible that Chile will win the World Cup? And grown men in the audience start weeping uncontrollably. I'm not kidding. They're completely broken down. So what the heck did I do? It turned out that the week before, Chile had lost 2-1 to Argentina and had been knocked out of World Cup contention. The rest of the questions become moot, right? Because once you can't get to the World Cup, you can't win it. Is it plausible? Is it probably not even worth asking? When I listen to founder stories or when I look at the DCF, the first question I ask is this possible? Because if it's not, why would I waste my time looking to see whether your beta makes sense, your cost of debt makes sense, or your cost of capital? It's a fairy tale. You can do whatever you want. Is it possible? Is it plausible? Is it probable? So let me give you examples of impossible stories, implausible stories, and improbable stories. You know what a fairness opinion is? Anybody know what a fairness opinion? Ritik, what's a fairness opinion?
Isn't it just an evaluation by an investment bank?
In what context usually?
About just how fair like a spinoff or a merger or acquisition is?
Usually it's in the context of a merger or acquisition that you're fairness opinion is the investment bank saying you're paying a fair price. You know why companies try to get fairness opinions? Because in 1986, I think, the Delaware court said that if you as a company get a fairness opinion at the time of a deal, you cannot be sued in the years after, even if the deal is the worst deal in the face of the earth. It's basically protection against getting sued. So almost every M&A deal, you'll see a fairness opinion. It's the most useless piece of paper ever. And here's why. Have you ever heard of a deal that was not able to be carried through because you could not get a fairness opinion? I have never heard of a single deal in history that was stopped because you couldn't. What does it tell you about fairness opinions? You can pay whatever you want and somebody's going to tell you that was okay. So usually when investment banks do fairness opinions, I cut them a lot of slack. They do really stupid things, but I say, you know what? I understand you have this mission to justify the unjustifiable. I let it go. But this was about 5 years ago in one of the most hopelessly conflicted deals of all time. Tesla announced it was going to buy SolarCity. You can see why it's hopelessly conflicted. Andreas, who's the largest shareholder in Tesla?
Isn't it Elon Musk?
It is Elon Musk. Who was the largest shareholder in SolarCity? Let me give you a clue. He had the same name as the largest shareholder in Tesla. There's a guy called Elon Musk. This isn't coincidence, same guy. You know, the CEO of Tesla was guy called Elon Musk. So today, what did he decide to rename himself? Techno King or something? Did you see that? He's renamed himself Techno King. Go figure. Who's the CEO of Tesla? You know who the CEO of SolarCity was? A guy called Musk with a different first name, his cousin. So when Tesla bought SolarCity, they knew they were going to get sued. So you know how they got protection? They decided to hire a couple of investment banks to do fairness opinions. And they needed fairness opinions on both Tesla and SolarCity because it was an exchange offer, that the offer was fair. So Tesla hires an outfit called Evercore. You heard of Evercore? Evercore is a boutique investment bank. You know what a boutique investment bank is? It's like a gastropub. You guys walk by gastropubs? Gastropubs are outfits in airports that you should just walk past because you know what a gastropub is. It's just a burger joint where they triple the price of everything, but they call it gastropub. So basically, it can charge you three times. So if you're a boutique investment bank, basically what you do is you do what investment banks do, but you charge three times the price. And Evercore is one of the most highly regarded boutique investment banks. So they're hired by Tesla to value Tesla. And SolarCity hires Lazard to value them so they can do the fairness opinion. So a few weeks later, the fairness opinion gets filed. I'm looking through the fairness opinion, again, willing to cut a lot of slack, that I get to the Tesla valuation by Evercore. And they've done what they call a DCF. Derek, help me out here. What do you need for a DCF? What are the two things you need? Let's cut to the core. You need sales, cash flows. And you need a discount rate, right? So I said, okay, let's see how Tesla got the cash flows. You know how Tesla got, how Evercore got its cash flows. You know how Evercore got the cash flows to value Tesla? Normally, when you think about cash flows, you estimate revenues and margins and reinvestment. That's not how Evercore got cash flows. It got the cash flows directly supplied to it by the Tesla board of directors. How this is expert or an opinion, I don't know, because you're getting the cash flows directly. You're saying, where did the Tesla board of directors get the cash flows? They got them from Goldman Sachs equity research. What a tangled web we weave when we're trying to deceive. You're saying, what's Goldman Sachs got to do with this? Goldman Sachs was Tesla's native investment bank. They got their equity research group to supply the cash flows to the board. The board gave it to Evercore. Evercore put in the spreadsheet. So the next 5 years, they have the cash flows. But at the end of year five, they had no more cash flows left. So what do you think they did after year five? They assumed a constant growth rate forever. Who knows, they might even use my textbook to do this. You know what they assumed as a growth rate forever? 6% a year. My first reaction is, what currency are you doing the valuation? Maybe it's Argentine pesos and you forgot to tell me. This is a US dollar valuation in 2016 and you're using a 6% growth forever. We said, so what? What do you think would happen to Tesla if it grew 6% a year forever? In an economy, US economy grows 2-3% in about 25 years, it'll be the US economy. Then what? Oh, globalization. In about 40 years, it'll be the global economy. I can't even visualize a world that's all Tesla all the time. You'd have to live in your Tesla, eat your Tesla, get healthcare and entertainment from your Tesla. Everything's got to be delivered by a Tesla. But after 40 years, then what? The only way I could get the story to work was to bring SpaceX into my story. You see what happens in this story? After 40 years, Tesla is now the entire world. So what do? They put Teslas on spaceships and send them to Mars. I don't know, wherever, Venus, Jupiter, wherever you decide to send it. This is an impossible valuation. In fact, I have described this as the worst valuation I've ever seen done. Not just by a bank, by anybody, anywhere. This is about as bad as it gets. And for churning out this piece of crap, you know how much EverQuote got paid? $9.5 million. There's no justice in this world. $9.5 million. This is an impossible valuation. You have valuations where people project revenues. I still remember somebody in this class about 4 years ago valuing Netflix. And they were projecting. So it was the middle of the semester, just like now. And they were, and I asked them to turn in their DCFs for feedback. So he turns in the DCF. And he's got this huge value for Netflix. I love Netflix as a company, but it's a company that's really difficult to find undervalued because it's so richly priced. But he came up with a value 4 times higher than the price. So I'm curious, what did he do? So look at his revenues. And he's projecting revenues of $600 billion in year 10 for Netflix. So I emailed him. This is when I was teaching in person. I said, can you come into my office? I need to talk to you about your DCF of Netflix. So he comes in. He says, what? And I said, no. Do you have Netflix? He said, yes. And I said, what do you pay each year for Netflix? That time he said, I pay about $100 a year. I said, okay, that's interesting. I notice you have $600 billion in revenues in year 10. How many subscribers would Netflix need to have in year 10? He pulled out his calculator, seemed to be attached to his hip. So I said, you don't need a calculator. You got revenues of 600 billion. You assume $100 per subscriber, that's $6 billion subscribers. Am I right? He said, I guess so. But he said, I don't know where this is going. I said, just hang in there. Just a couple more questions and I'll let you go. I said, what's the population of the world? He said, I don't know, but seven. I said, let me fill in the details, about seven and a half billion. I said, is there something you're not telling me? Maybe there's a law that's been passed that every man, woman, and child on the face of the earth has to have a Netflix account and they're not allowed to share. He said, don't be absurd. I said, I'm not the one estimating 600 billion in revenues. You are. You know what he said? I was just using last year's numbers. I said, what? He said, I took the growth rate in subscribers last year, which was 40%, and I made that my growth rate every year for the next 10 years. It's amazing what compounding can do to your numbers. My suggestion when you value a company is focus on your revenues in year 10. Forget about the revenues in year 1, 2. Look at that revenue number in year 10, and here's the question I want you to think about. What story for your company can explain those revenues? So whether it's 100 billion, 10 billion, or 20 billion, I need to know what you think about this company to allow them to generate those revenues. So those are impossible valuations. You're pushing the limit and beyond. Implausible valuations are valuations which can happen, but you need to have a really good explanation for why. I'll give you my favorite example. About 3 years ago, somebody was valuing a toll road company. my class, is an Asian toll road company, publicly traded company. He was projecting huge revenue growth for the next 5 or 6 years. No, actually for the next 10 years, but no reinvestment. And usually that's a mismatch. How do you grow without reinvesting? So I pushed back and he gave me a story, which once I heard the story, I said, that makes sense. He said, this toll road company has been building toll roads for the last 10 years. They just opened their first toll roads last year. The growth is coming from more people using the toll roads, but they're done building. They have no reinvestment, lots of growth. You know what? I backed off. In fact, when you send in your DCFs on April 2nd, those of you who choose to do it, here's what I'm going to check. I'm going to check your growth assumptions. And remember, the growth assumptions could be high, average, or low, and I'm not going to push back. I'm going to look at your reinvestment assumptions. Remember, that's the difference between your earnings and your cash flow, what you're putting back in the business, and your reinvestment assumption can be high, average, or low. And then I'm going to look at what your risk assumptions give you as a cost of capital. Remember, the median cost of capital in dollar terms for a company is 6%. I'm looking to see whether they have an 8 or 9 or 10% cost of capital or a 4% cost of capital. And here's why. If you have high growth, here's what I expect to see. I expect to see high reinvestment and a high cost of capital. If you have low growth, I expect to see low reinvestment and a low cost of capital. And if I don't see that match, I'm looking for your story of why your company is different. So you give me high growth, low reinvestment, low risk. Be prepared with a story that just, it's not impossible, but you need to come up with a strong story to justify it. So my Uber story, I was not being that ambitious. Urban car service company, because I was not being ambitious, it was clearly possible. They were already doing it, plausible and probable. I was able to pass the test. Now, if I told a much bigger story for Uber, this would be a much more difficult test to pass. So I'm going to end today's session with what I call the runaway story. You know what a runaway story is? It's a story you like so much that you want it to be true. And here's what you will see as ingredients in a runaway story. You'll usually see a storyteller, a narrator, who's very charismatic, maybe even likable. He's telling a story about disrupting a business you've never liked. And finally, he's also telling you that while this story plays out, that he's going to make the world a better place. So you've got a charismatic storyteller, a story disrupting a business you've never liked. And if the story plays out, the world is going to be a better place. So you want the story to be true. So let's make this less abstract. Let me tell you a story. And you tell me whether this story is a story you would like to be true. It's about a 19-year-old who drops out of Stanford. Who does that? What is the acceptance rate at Stanford last year? Like -3%, unless you happen to be a synchronized swimmer or came in through the side door. One of the most selective universities in the world, this person gets in and drops out at 19 to start a business. Now, part of you saying, now the software guy. Now, this is a woman who drops out at 19 to start a blood testing business, and she's going to revolutionize the blood testing business. It's a business that none of us has ever liked, right? Because right now, how is it structured? You go to a laboratory, they extract like 2 buckets of blood from you. I think they give it to Dracula to drink, but they take forever to run the tests. And then you got to jump through all these hoops to get them. The whole thing costs you like $800. This woman has created a blood testing business where she takes 2 drops of your blood, puts it in a nanotainer, test for 32 different things, and you have the results in 45 minutes, the whole thing will cost less than $50. And to boot, she's going to make it freely available to people who can't afford it, the rest of the world. Come on, don't you want this story to be true? I wish I'd made up this story, because this is, of course, the true story of Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. And boy, a lot of people want it to be true, because by the middle of 2015, the company was priced at $9 billion, which means there were a lot of VCs who thought it was worth a lot. And I assumed that they would have asked the question. You know, the question I expected them to ask was, right, it's a blood testing business. Does the blood test work? In October of 2015, a Wall Street Journal reporter decides to ask the question. He goes to the FDA and asks, has the company been approved, Theranos been approved for these 32 tests they claim to run on the blood? And the FDA said they've been approved for only one. We can't approve them for the other 31. And he asked, why not? The tests are a little noisy. You know what a noisy blood test looks like? Trust me, you don't want it. Because this is a blood test, the results come back. The doctor says, you know what? you could be dying. You could be really sick, or nothing could be wrong with you. Don't worry about it. Go home. Not exactly what you want in a blood test, right? So when that report came out, Theranos threatened to sue the journal, and the journal stuck with its story. 6 months later, you know what had happened to the pricing? It had gone to zero. It turned out that Theranos was cooking the books. In fact, this story became a book. If you get a chance, you should read it. I'll get you the title and the reference. It's also a movie. Somebody, I know who's playing, you know, Elizabeth Holmes. Elizabeth Holmes has been sued by the FDA. Her case was supposed to start this week. She's now pregnant. The case has been put off for a few months. But this is a runaway story. It happens more often than you want. In fact, runaway stories, because they're built around personalities, can very quickly melt down. If you get a chance, read my posts on WeWork when it went public in 2019. You know who the CEO of WeWork was? A guy called Adam Neumann. If you get a chance, go on Google, type in Adam Neumann. You know how he became famous? Through a TEDx talk. The TEDx talk was the power of we, which of course became WeWork and the $60 billion company, charismatic, narcissistic, which makes the we kind of strange to use because he talked about community. But he got a lot of people to buy into his story. And then what did we discover? That he was an arrogant, self-indulged, basically, you know, not quite grown up. And guess what happened to the WeWork story? It completely melted down. So when you hear a story and I said, that's such a good story, I wish it were true, be careful, because it's easy to delude yourself with these stories that they are in fact true. So as you tell your story, make sure that you're not telling a runaway story. Why? Because you love Elon Musk so much and you want to buy Tesla, you're gonna find a way to buy it. And step back and think about your story, make it pass through those tests and be honest at least with yourself. So I'm gonna end with that. I'll stop sharing, but if any questions, kind of hang around and you can ask me the questions, because I'll hang around for a few minutes.
Professor, I have a quick question.
Go ahead.
How did you figure out the method that Evercore used when they were valuing Tesla?
Because it was the SEC filings actually put out their entire DCF. It's a public filing. So in fact, if you want to see really bad valuations, go to the SEC and you can see fairness opinions, because they're actually supposed to be public documents, because that's what the court required to protect people. So you can actually see what companies do, and they do horrifically bad things. Lazard did a little better, but you know how they got the terminal value? What did we say? There was the one method you shouldn't use to get a terminal value.
Yeah.
Multiple. 6x EBITDA. Yeah. So fairness opinions show you how empty banking DCFs are. So if you go to work in a bank, the DCF is like for show. The pricing is what drives the game. And so, you know, what I'm trying to do is ask you not to get frustrated, because if you spend too much time debating cost of capital and country risk in a bank, you're going to get shunned, because it really doesn't matter. You're telling a fairy tale. Who cares what the cost of capital really is? It's cynical, but it's in fact the truth. You have a job to do. You got to get the deal done. The deal is a pricing deal, and the DCF is there for sure.
Got it. And what response are you met with when you bring this up to people? I'm sure you
speak. I did this at Evercore.
What's that?
I did this at Evercore. I actually did their own valuation. They know it. I mean, how can you deny it? It's not like it's a matter of, you know, could be. Of course, they all know it. In fact, I wrote an article for the Delaware court judges on the questions they need to be asking investment banks when they present fairness opinions. Because that's what will change this game, is if the courts start asking, hey, this is supposed to be a fairness opinion. You're supposed to be giving an objective estimate of value. What's this crap you're turning in as a fairness opinion? You know how quickly this will change? But until they start to do that, this is for show. This is defense against future lawsuits. That's all a fairness opinion is. And now you're buying yourself protection, and that's too bad. It's a waste of money and it's a waste of time.
Got it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions, guys?
Thanks, no? Professor.
Take care.
Have a good one.